When I think of snow, I usually think of outdoors, downhill skiing, sledding, tobogganing, having a lot of fun outside, Christmas.
When I think of snow, I think of building snowmen and the peaceful, muffled noises of the cars going by. Happy times.
Peace and quiet and whiteness.
When I think of snow, I think of quietness. Walk in the woods.
Tunnels, making tunnels and igloos and fun time.
When I think of snow, I think of cold, powdery, potentially fun, but potentially dangerous substance.
Snow is often a reminder of fun times. However, snow can have tragic effects. This was true Friday, January 26, 1978. The worst winter storm in Ohio history slammed into the northwest corner of the state. Temperatures plunged 30 degrees in about 2 hours, and wind chills measured below minus 50 degrees through much of Ohio. A devastating wind and a deep blanket of snow paralyzed all transportation. People stranded in vehicles, trapped in unheated homes, or caught outdoors were targets for a freezing death. This program presents eyewitness stories from the people of Northwest Ohio who lived through this storm. Stories of survival, courage, humor, and death. It also tells the story of people pulling together during a fearful time.
Just incredible. The community, the sense of community that developed, and I think remained for many years thereafter, even to today, to the blizzard survivors.
Those who were there know that the heart of our people produced a warmth that eventually melted this chilling confrontation with Mother Nature. Wednesday, January 25th, 1978.
The night before the storm, at that time it was the last year that I was working in radio, and we were broadcasting Bowling Green State University basketball games. And the Falcons were on the road that night at Kent State. And I was with Dave Carr. We had traveled over to Kent, and on the way home it rained. It rained very hard all the way from Kent. And I remember we arrived back to Bowling Green, it was just about midnight. And just as we turned onto my street, the rain was turning over to huge, wet snowflakes. And then I got in the house and went to bed, and the next morning it was here.
And so I started to stay up and at first watched Johnny Carson, and then from there I knew, since I didn't have to get up in the morning, I even decided to stay up even longer and watch an old movie on TV. But by the time that movie had ended, the rain was still coming down, and it was still 50 degrees, and I thought that I had made a gross error because of a weather report that I was going to now be in a grouchy mood in front of a bunch of seventh graders the next morning because I had too little sleep.
The great blizzard starts off innocently enough. There's been a drizzle most of this unseasonably warm day. Residents fear the light rain will freeze over and lead to dangerously slippery conditions on the roads. Although freezing rain is hazardous, Ohioans recognize it as a fact of life and heartily adapt to it.
The evening before the blizzard, it was raining, and my wife, who had a reputation for exaggerating the weather report, tried to talk me into staying home. Because there was a blizzard coming, and here it is, it's raining cats and dogs. And I laughingly told her, well, I'll be home if I have to walk.
Three major storm movements, hundreds of miles from each other, are bearing down on Northwest Ohio. The first is a low pressure which has formed over Oklahoma and is ambling northeast. The second is a cold air mass which is hurtling down from Minnesota and Wisconsin, carrying temperatures between 0 and -10 degrees. As if vying for its share of attention, a movement of warm, moist air shoots through the Cumberland Gap in Tennessee. This warm air proceeds northward over Kentucky and southern Ohio, bearing unseasonably warm temperatures of about 75 degrees. Thursday, January 26th, 4 a.m. The low pressure sucks in the cold air mass from the north and the warm, moist air from the south, and the three weather movements angrily collide. Suddenly, the northwest Ohio sky is a battleground. The warm weather, with temperatures between 50 and 55 degrees, suddenly turns frigid. This icy air transforms the drizzle into freezing rain, then into snow. 6 a.m. A substantial snow is now carpeting northwest Ohio. The low pressure touches off gale force winds. The temperature plunges to near minus 10 degrees. The frigid cold and blinding snow are now extremely dangerous, life-threatening to anyone unfortunate enough to be caught outside.
I woke up at about 5:30 in the morning to tremendous thunder and lightning and a combination of what at that time looked like hail and rain. This being wintertime, it was just very frightening, but didn't know what was going on, but no snow to speak of. Within the next 30 or 45 minutes, the thunder and lightning turned into a blinding snowstorm. Truly, what we were later to discover was the blizzard. Temperatures began dropping rapidly, and it was a very, very frightening experience to just see the fury of that storm come upon us with little or no warning.
I was first aware that storm hit when my wife, Sally, came in and woke me up. And she said, we can't see the neighbor's house. She said, you absolutely can't believe it outside. And I'm a person that likes snow, and I went to the window quick to look around. And it was true, you could see absolutely nothing. The snow was coming down so hard, and it was so a blowing effect that visibility was down to zero.
When my wife Kathy woke me up early in the morning, it was approximately 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and her first words to me were Roger, the train is blowing its horn, the train is back. And Conrail had abandoned the tracks that were just two doors away several months before, and I thought, well, that can't be, there's something wrong. But then it was very possible that they may have been running some sort of train and maybe it had gotten in trouble, derailed or something. And I thought, well, I better go down to take a look. And as I started going down the stairs, I noticed that the windows were completely whited out. There was no light. The lights were not working. And I noticed that what she thought was the train going through town was actually the wind blowing, which we found out later to be about 60 miles an hour.
We thought it was going to be a blizzard, big snow, 6-8 inches of snow. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning when we realized it had been snowing all night and wasn't going to stop, that we saw some real problems here. Before we got done, our parking lot in the back was level with the top of our steps, and we have two, three, four steps going up to the back of the radio station. The parking lot was level with snow. The cars that had been there were buried.
We were going to go out and get wood for the wood-burning stove and found out the doors wouldn't open. Everything had been frozen shut. We knew the night before it was coming. They had had a warning about 10 o'clock at night, a blizzard warning, but they say that a lot, so we weren't really prepared for it.
When we got ready for work the next morning and opened up the carport door and I couldn't find my 3/4-ton pickup truck, we knew it was bad.
The wind now blows cruelly with gusts nearly 60 miles an hour.
The wind was almost piercing. I mean, it was like a knife. The wind was worse than the snow. You couldn't tell whether it was really snowing or whether it was blowing because the wind had the snow going absolutely parallel to the ground. It wasn't swirling, it wasn't coming down. It was just knifing through you. You absolutely couldn't see. It was stinging your face, it would sting your hands. Any exposed surface of your skin, it was just unbearable.
The storm deposits about 14 inches of snow, causing drifts measured in feet. Thursday morning. The storm is most brutal to the northwest Ohio counties of Wood, Hancock, Lucas, and Ottawa. Temperatures plummet within homes and factories as gas and electricity promptly gives out. The vehicles of travelers and early morning commuters are suddenly paralyzed in the snow, many of their occupants trapped inside. Bill Blair volunteers to help the Wood County Civil Defense during this time of crisis. However, he must first trudge his way through the snow to a halfway point at the Wood County Hospital. A snowmobile meets him there and transports him to the command center at Wood County Courthouse.
Well, traveling through the snow itself, it was very exhausting because it was over waist deep and to get over to the hospital. And I was working up quite a sweat doing it. I remember that I was really exhausted by the time I got to the hospital. And then I wasn't really dressed to ride a snowmobile. And that was very cold getting to the courthouse. But by being in the snow, getting to the hospital, I realized it was much worse than I had originally thought.
Upon arriving at the command center, Blair and other volunteers discover many rural residents are without phone service, relying on CB radios to communicate.
The very first day when we got in there, there was nothing we could do. There absolutely, again, nothing was moving but snowmobiles. So when people were calling, we were trying to calm them down to tell them that they had contact with us, we were listening to them.
Our primary move at the radio station at WIMA at that time was to communicate with people who needed help. Most of those people, and they've told us this afterwards, said their only link with the outside world was that portable radio they had. They had no lights. They, in many cases, had no gas, no heat. They didn't know if anybody knew they were there until they heard it on the radio and knew that they were in a problem situation and they weren't alone. They really liked that situation altogether. In many cases, it's a case of sitting in the dark, wondering if anybody knows you're there, and the radio was their only way they could find it out.
The voices were absolute panic. You had a whiteout during the day, and then at night when it got dark, the only thing you had was voices, you know, on the radio or on the phone. And you probably felt more helpless at night.
It's a general feeling of if you've ever been in a room when the lights go out, that's a temporary thing for you. But when you look out your window and you can't see lights anywhere, it's a lonesome, lonesome feeling. And those people wanted to know that other people knew they were there. And then they realized they may be there for a long, long time and they didn't know what to do.
The storm dumped so much snow, nobody could get anywhere. The snowmobilers were having trouble getting out of town by following roads because cars were completely drifted over and they were busting the runners, hitting these submerged cars underneath all the snow. There was also the added problem with all the lines down, they were running into lines. I remember a deputy calling in on the radio that he had just tripped over something, and he was out on Route 6, and he said, "My God, I just tripped over a power line." And he said, "The snow is that deep out here. It was up to the tops of the power lines."
At the time of the blizzard, I was living in a trailer about a mile or so outside of Brandon, Ohio. Very isolated location, no neighbors in the immediate vicinity. And trailers aren't noted for being weatherproof in any event. So when the snow started to fly, it actually began coming in through the windows of the trailer, even though they were closed. The temperature in the trailer began to drop, and then the electricity went out. And it dropped rapidly, more than 10 degrees every 30 minutes. So after the first couple of hours, I thought there was a real danger of freezing to death. My first priority was to let my parents know I was okay and let my work know I wasn't going to be coming in. The next thing that really hit me is the temperature was dropping in the trailer. It was dropping rapidly, even though the power was still on. So I began to close windows even more tightly, see what I could do to stop the flow of air coming into the trailer. Then the power went out. When the power went out, the temperature dropped rapidly, and I began to be concerned that there was a real possibility I was going to freeze to death. I started putting on all my clothing and walled off an area of the trailer to keep warm.
I was a production supervisor at Cooper Tire and Rubber in Findlay, Ohio. On December 26th, I was working from 10 o'clock in the evening till 6 o'clock in the morning. And we lost power. Which creates panic situations. The wind was making more noise than a 2,500 horsepower electric motor. It was just unbelievable. The snow was blowing in
doors and windows like they weren't even there. We were getting drifts in front of truck doors that normally nothing ever passed through. The drifting outside the plant was already, within an hour or so, was already to the peaks of the lower portions of the buildings. I had laughingly told the wife I was going to walk home. If this had kept up, I was still thinking about walking home, but with all this snow and everything, it was just not something I had really expected. At that point, I still figured on going home, but I wasn't quite exactly certain when it was going to happen. When I finally was able to start my walk home, it was in the evening, and it was one of the only times I can ever remember really looking at a calendar and seeing moonrise, moonset. And I actually walked home during that night. After looking at the calendar, I saw that the moon came up at 8:16 and set at 6:18. And it's interesting that you remember that, but that gave me light to walk home.
Melvin was at work, and he talked to his wife, and he knew that the electricity was out. The storm had knocked electricity out, so he decided to leave work early, and he stopped at Kroger's to pick up a few groceries on the way home, and then he proceeded on home in his truck. He got on the road that he lived on. It was County Road 215, and he was in contact with someone with CB radio, and they said that he told them that his truck was stuck in the snow and he was shoveling the snow, and he was proceeding to try to go on home. At that time, he's about a mile and a half from home. When we found the truck was, there was no snow around it at all, and the shovel was in the back of the truck. The wind could have blown all the snow away, because it kept shifting. And from that point, he proceeded to his home on foot.
During the blizzard, my dad had battened down the hatches. He had taken the garage door and tied it to the framing, and that prevented the snow and the ice from blowing in the garage. And I went out in the garage and noticed an orange hue to the east. And I told Daddy better come out and untie the garage door so we could get a look at what was going on. And the neighbor's house next door had caught fire. And it was kind of ironic, because after we lost power, the neighbors asked us to come over to keep warm.
During the storm, a big tree had fallen on our neighbor's house. She was an elderly widow lady, didn't want to leave her home. So my husband got out and went up over, got on her roof with his chainsaw to cut away this tree. And so then I kept trying to check on him out our back door. Couldn't see him because the snow was just blowing so hard, like 50 miles an hour. And it was like looking through a white sheet. I could still hear the chainsaw, so I knew he was up there. After he got that cleared, he went inside and patched the roof from the inside, and then took time to clean out the snow that had fallen in her hallway.
The blizzard causes the worst stoppage of transportation in the history of Ohio. Massive snowdrifts make even extended travel by snowmobile impossible. Disaster relief agencies and volunteers are now able to assess critical and dangerous situations clearly. One desperate incident involves the transport of a West Millgrove baby to a hospital in Bowling Green.
The baby was badly dehydrated and was going to die. We had worked with a helicopter pilot that was stranded out at the airport to get his copter fueled. The gas pumps at the airport were all frozen, and we went out and built a shelter to get it out of the wind. And then we got heaters inside to get the pumps unfrozen, thaw them out, to get fuel for the helicopter.
But it was conditions that absolutely under any normal circumstances would never be done. I mean, you're just forbidden to fly in this kind of weather. But for what we were trying to accomplish and what we had to do, the risk was worth it, in my opinion.
Doug Valentine at this time was had gotten involved and was out at the airport trying to get things going out there. And the helicopter pilot said he would make one flight for us. And it was to go get that baby. The doctor kept calling and said, you got 12 hours. This was when we're still thawing out the gas pumps. We couldn't get the helicopter started. It was frozen. I remember the we were down to 6 hours, 3 hours, and he was calling constantly and said, if you don't get here, don't bother coming.
With time running out, rescuers resort to a dangerous scheme to warm up the helicopter's engine.
I remember the helicopter pilot told us, it's not doing us any good. We had a salamander heater that we were using to thaw out the engine, get it ready. And we stuck that salamander right on the engine and blew heat on it, and we got it started.
Live flames exposed to aviation fuel and oil on the aircraft would be the most dangerous part of this, because of the salamander heaters are oil fed, and there are sparks that comes out of these heaters as they burn. And that was very dangerous to igniting the fuel that was on the aircraft, and then we had it covered with tarps, which held everything right there. So vapor from gasoline couldn't escape. It had to be under the tarps at the time we were heating.
The pilot, he was flying, I believe he was flying for AT&T, checking out lines, so he was not from the area. So Doug Valentine got in the copter with him because he did know the area, and flew to meet the doctor and the baby.
They handed the child to me. I brought the child in on my lap, put my belt in such a manner that it had us both belted in, and then the aircraft people cleared the area. The aircraft lifted off, returned, and came back the opposite direction, right straight back to Bowling Green, to Wood County Hospital. Landed at Wood County Hospital under the same basis where they lit flares, had a spot cleared, and when it landed, nurses and staff come running to the aircraft with a gurney and with people to get the baby.
He got the baby back, and the baby survived. But I still can't talk about it. It was the one incident that really got to us all. And I remember when I went home, you know, Sally said, how bad is it? And I hadn't been home for about 3 days. And I couldn't even talk about it to her without breaking down. None of us really said much about it. It was just something that we did, and we got the gratification of saving a life.
My situation before the storm hit was that I was pregnant with my first child. My due date was February 2nd, and I was at the doctor's office that Wednesday, and he told me it'd be another week he'd see me. And I was feeling fine, excited. Once the storm hit, we found that we couldn't get to the hospital, couldn't even get around town. The drifts were too deep.
And I called the police and told them, you know, I said, I have a Jeep truck, and I said, I can take her to the hospital. And they said, no, the snow's too bad, you can't get out. And I said, but I have a Jeep with four-wheel drive. And he said, if you can't get out of town, there's no roads or streets that are cleared. And I said, well, okay. I said, my wife's in labor. I said, she went into labor about 7 o'clock this morning. And they said, well, you're going to have to do something else. So we called Dr. Roberts at the time.
I was informed by the emergency people in North Baltimore, who were all holding forth at the City Hall, and they said that Karen was in labor and wondered whether I would go see her, and I did. And when I got there, she was perfectly willing to have her delivery at home, so we decided to go ahead and do a home delivery.
Ohio Governor James Rhodes orders the Ohio National Guard to report for duty. President Jimmy Carter declares Ohio a disaster area. Sergeant Kenneth Snyder of the Ohio National Guard is activated and ordered to report for duty to an armory near Toledo. After making good progress through the snow, his four-wheel drive truck suddenly plunges into a snowbank.
The truck just, boom, stopped. I tried to get out the left door, and I couldn't get out that. I tried to get out the right door. So I crawled out the back, and I was in a snowdrift that was 20 feet deep, 20 foot high. And when I did leave home, I took a scoop shovel with me, so I had to dig it out so it dropped down and get enough and backed out there.
Once clear of the drift, Sergeant Snyder sets out to the armory.
I saw a car in a snowdrift, and so I got out of my car and brushed the snow away where I could look in the window, and there was a person in a car. It was a gentleman there. I got him out, got him in my Ram Charger, got him warmed up, got to talking to him, and he had worked for the railroad out of Walbridge there, and he'd been in that car since 7 o'clock this morning when he got off duty, and he was stuck in there, and of course he ran out of fuel.
When Melvin left the truck, he went on down the road, County Road 215, and according to the footprints, he was walking in the middle of the road, and probably about a half mile from where he lived, there was a big snowdrift in the road, and he had to go out in the field. And he was following a fence row, and at that particular point is where he got on the wrong fence row. He started going east instead of going north, which would have took him right to his house. So he ended up about a quarter mile away from his house.
As I was walking home, I passed by what is now the License Examination Bureau in Finley. At that time, it was AMC Garage. And I was able to reach out, point my hands at the power lines, and they were just about level with where I was walking. And in order to be that level, I knew I had to be at least 15 feet in the air. And I'm walking along thinking, boy, this is kind of funny. This is a lot of snow, and there was a lot of strange emotions going through my mind. I came to the end of the snowdrift. And I tumbled three times end over end and landed on dry pavement. And it was the wind was doing weird things with the snow. At some places that were totally clear, other places there was so much snow it was almost unfathomable. I came to one point where I had followed an angled road, and I realized I had made I was a little bit off course because I recognized a barn on one side, and right about that time power came on to a small farmhouse. And they were very close to a substation there. And I went to this house, and I spent several hours at this house getting warmed back up and actually enjoying a little bit of electric benefits.
When we woke up that morning, the walls were actually moving. We lived in a modular home at the time, and the walls were actually moving from the wind. And there was even some snow in the living room along the baseboard. And the cat was just batting it around once we brought the cat in from outside. And it was just very cold, and it got progressively colder to the point where we could see our breath, and it just continued to get colder, and our furnace wasn't working because of the wind. And so we were bundling up, and we decided at some point that we had to leave because it was so cold. It was frightening because we knew what it was like outside, at least from the window, we knew what it was like outside, and we didn't really want to go out there, but we knew that we couldn't stay in the house. We got to the point where we knew that we had no option but to try to leave the house and go to the neighbors where we could have shelter and some warmth. So it was a very difficult decision, and we did not make that decision early. But we had to eventually make that decision to leave the house.
My wife was in the furniture business. She had won an all-expense trip for the two of us to Hawaii. We would be leaving from Cleveland on Saturday, and the blizzard hit Thursday. The rain quickly turned into snow and escalated into the super blizzard, and it snowed for a couple of more days. Bowling Green being the center of the storm, or Wood County being the center of the storm, we were pretty well trapped in Bowling Green. There was no way out. By Saturday, the weather wasn't that bad in Cleveland. The charter went, and so there was no way it could be postponed. So we just missed the trip.
As the temperature continued to drop, I turned on the stove of the trailer, but you don't want to just leave that on because there's a real possibility of being asphyxiated by the fumes. So I actually built a reflector oven back from my Boy Scout training out of aluminum foil, with the vent of the stove remaining open and the heat being reflected to me by the aluminum foil. And I was actually, by walling off the area, having this reflector oven built, able to get the air temperature where I was sitting up to about 50 degrees. So then I knew I was going to make it. I wasn't going to die.
I got to Lindquist by snowmobile, and I had no problem with the guy that took me that day, but the guy the day before, I'd gone on a house call, and I was sitting on the back of the snowmobile with my bag on my lap, and the guy went around the corner, and I went off the snowmobile with minimum damage. And so I got a different driver the second day. We went over the fences and didn't even have to follow the street, which you couldn't see anyway. It was only about a 5-minute ride.
My husband described the scene of the doctor arriving as looking like Santa Claus coming up over the fence, because he had his snowmobile suit on and a big pack with him of all the supplies. And the drifts came up over the fence, so he just walked right over the back fence, didn't realize the fence was there.
He said not to get nervous, and he made arrangements to get a hold of June Ray, his nurse. She was living in town at the time. Her house had burnt, and she was living in an apartment. And the same guy that brought him down on the snowmobile made a trip and found her and brought her to the house.
It was a little bit scary. I did know the driver, and I trusted him. Yeah, he knew the terrain quite well, but it was extremely cold, and no one was on the street. It was very eerie, and it must have been at least a mile ride. And I didn't have proper clothing, but I did have layers on, so I made it okay.
Chris Cooperrider is pregnant and needs a snowmobile ride to nearby Interstate 75. From there, she can be transported to the hospital in Bowling Green.
So my husband went over and asked the neighbor to radio for help, that anyone that had a sled, you know, if they could bring it out. Right after that, he comes back over, and this guy comes up. He was dressed all in black snowmobile, and he had a black sled on the back. So he got us all bundled in and everything was fine. And we went to Cygnet, and Cygnet had an ambulance waiting for us. So they were trying to get me in the ambulance, and I'm all worried because I had taken a quilt, and I wanted to make sure I had this quilt. And so I'm getting the quilt in the ambulance, and all of a sudden we decide we need to thank this guy that got us there, and he was gone. And so we asked the emergency squad to thank him when they saw him again, and they go, "We thought you knew him." And we're going, "No, we thought he was part of the emergency squad because he came right after we radioed." And they said, "Oh, well, it must be somebody that heard your CB announcement that you needed help and showed up." Well, later on, my husband had gone to the neighbors to thank him for radioing, and the neighbor said, "I couldn't get the CB radio to work." So we still have no clue who this guy in black was. But the emergency squad didn't seem to know either, so it was kind of a mystery.
When we made the decision to leave, we were planning to walk to Hazel's house, and Hazel was an elderly neighbor who lived approximately an eighth of a mile from our house. She was just north of us. It was a difficult decision because visibility was so poor at that time and the wind was so strong, and we decided to leave dressed in many layers of clothing, and we attempted to walk to her house. And I was very disoriented walking there because of the blowing snow and the heavy wind, and I think probably the cold as well. The noise associated with the wind that strong was incredible. The noise, it was eerie almost. The wind was so strong, and it would almost take your breath away when you were facing winds like that. And it was just a penetrating cold and just very eerie, actually.
My biggest problem in walking home, I did not have goggles. And I only ran into one other person who was out out of doors that night on purpose. It was a snowmobiler. And he probably doesn't realize how close he came to hitting me. Because as much problems as I was having seeing, I'm sure that the faceplate on his snowmobile mask was totally iced over, and because he missed me by mere inches. And he probably never figured there was anybody else out there, and he probably never even saw me. I came upon a truck that was sitting with its engine running, and as I passed the truck, I all of a sudden realized that some guys were pounding on the window, and it was a truck from Virginia, and there were two truckers in it, and all they had were sweatshirts. And part of what I was wearing a snowsuit, and then I was wearing a hooded coat on top of the snowsuit. And what I did is I gave them the hooded coat, and one at a time I walked them about a little less than a quarter of a mile to the Findlay Airport, which had a generator and had heat at that time. They were unable to walk facing the storm. I had to link arms with them, and they walked backwards till we got to that particular location. I walked them both over there, and they were eternally grateful. It was just, you know, they couldn't believe that of such a storm.
Well, we had a guy who volunteered who had been in radio in Columbus and was in Lima, and he stopped in and said, "Can I help out?" and told us his qualifications, and he was a dynamite guy on the air, and he helped us out tremendously, but he also apparently either ran a stable or knew of several young ladies who worked as women of the night. One of them showed up at the back door with a big pot of chili. She was dealing more than chili. We, at the radio station, ate the chili and sent her on her way. We appreciated the chili.
There was two brothers that came early. We was forming a search party, and Lloyd Noss, the neighbor, asked them to start checking the fence rows. They found Melvin about 3 feet away from a fence post. He was following a fence row going east, and he was face down in the snow, and he froze to death. Although we believe that he didn't really realize what danger he's in because he had his hands over his face to keep his face warm. I haven't decided yet. I'm still having trouble dealing with your death. It will follow me all my life. I can't forget you, but I must get on with my life and start facing all the problems in my own life, Melvin. I just can't describe how much I miss you.
It was still snowing hard on the second day. Still wind. Wind and snow kept up for the first 2 days. I remember when we were trying to get the parts out to the electric crew that we got stuck in the snow. It was such a blinding snow.
The persistent storm conditions continue to place Northwest Ohio residents in grave conditions. Many Wood County residents are without
water, electricity, and food. There have been 6 confirmed deaths. Betty Bowling and her 4 children were taken by helicopter from their rural home near Custer.
The wind blew our front door down, and we had 3 to 4 inches of snow inside our house. And we were without food and water and electricity from Thursday morning till they brought us in here Saturday afternoon. Freezing.
The one instance, again, that was very difficult, we had a call from a rural family, and they said they had no heat and that they were burning in the fireplace what wood they had. They called back about every hour to let us know what condition they were in. We got hold of a farmer with a large farm tractor who was going to try to make his way to them. They again would call back and said, "We're now burning the furniture." And the last call we had from them was, "The only thing left to burn is the front door." And they did that. They took the front door off, and just then the tractor arrived. And so it did get them and got them out. Well, we were taking those parts out to the Bowling Green Electric crew, and we got stuck. And we're sitting there in the Jeep, and we had been there for probably an hour and waiting, and all of a sudden somebody knocked on the side of the Jeep, and we opened the door, and here is a young man in cross-country skis, and he said, "Hey, what's happening?" And he said, "There's a blizzard going on." And I said, "Where'd you come from?" And he said, "Well, I walked in from the trailer park out here." He said, "I was bored and decided to come into town to see what was going on."
I got home about 7 o'clock in the morning, and my wife was not totally surprised to see me. She says, "I sort of expected you'd be getting here before too long." I got the name of Bigfoot from my wife. Some of the equipment that I walked home in was handmade, including my boots. When I walked with these, and I'd had these boots for about a year, I left a big track, and my wife had laughingly told the reporter that I was Bigfoot.
And Tom realized that we were veering east when we wanted to go north and got us back on track. But we were very close to Hazel's home before we could actually see that we were there. We just had no sense of how close we were until we were right there, basically. 1/8 of a mile seemed like many miles in a wind like that. When we arrived at Hazel's, we were greeted warmly, and it was a relief to be there finally, to be out of the heavy wind and the deep snow and the cold temperatures, and to know that we had a safe, warm environment. She lived in a brick home with her German Shepherd, and I think she was grateful to have us there. And she wanted to ensure that we were very comfortable, and she knew we had been very cold. So when we went to bed that night, Hazel turned the thermostat up, thinking that we might be still cold, and actually overdid it, I think, with the heat during the night, and probably turned it up to about 90 degrees. It was a big contrast from the outside temperature.
I thought the delivery was a little on the difficult side. She was trying to come out face up instead of face down, and it was difficult, 12-hour delivery, but everything turned out fine in the end.
The delivery, was, as far as I was concerned, was normal. She had a little difficulty with what's called the malpresentation, but this resolved itself over a period of 5 or 6 hours, and she had a perfectly normal delivery on the Davenport. My biggest problem for the whole thing was to make out the birth certificate, because in the hospital, the hospital gals all take care of the birth certificate, and usually this was all made out, and you go in to see the patient the next day and sign it, and that was all there was to it. But I had to fill out all the questions and see that the health department got it, and apparently it worked all right because they didn't send it back.
I'm glad it's all over, and I wouldn't want to do it that way again. But it was quite an experience. We were fortunate to have a good doctor like we did, that cared and could make it down.
Angela's doing good today. She got married, and she's finishing her senior year at Defiance.
I said something to Angie when I saw her, that she ought to have a pretty nice belly button, and she looked at her mom and she said, "Should I show him?" And she had two or three rings in it. And I said, "Here, I've got you a nice belly button, and you had to put rings in it." But she's a nice kid.
Have cars been giving you any trouble, abandoned cars out there?
Yeah, there's quite a few. People just leave them where they sit, and they block streets off. Then you have to back down the whole street and find another way out, and that backs traffic back up, and just slows everything down.
It was very difficult to keep cars off the road. In fact, the police finally said if they caught anybody on the road, they'd arrest them. The cars that got stranded early when the storm first hit were all covered with snow. People would say, I haven't missed a day of work in 15 years and I'm going in. Well, there was nowhere they could go. And I don't think they really realized either how bad the snow storm was. So if they got by the barricades, because not all roads obviously had a police or a deputy at them, they would go out and get hung up in the drift, and we'd either have to go out and rescue them, or we wouldn't hear about it, and they'd abandon their car. Then another one would get piled up, snow would come in, cover it, and then our plows couldn't move at all. You couldn't clear a road because of all of the road being littered with abandoned automobiles. And there's no keys in them, you can't move them. So I know on one instance or two where the car was just pushed off the side of the road.
Well, you get a street and come back over it, and the wind's got it all drifted over again. So it's just fighting a losing battle until the wind dies down. And then we can, get it pushed over and start moving it out.
The biggest problem with removing the snow wasn't a place to put it. When you had snow drifts that were 8, 10, 12, 15 feet high, you couldn't get anything to take it up that high. You know, we weren't equipped, again, with equipment like they have in, say, Colorado that'll blow the snow out and blow it high. We just had to pick it up in buckets and back it up. I mean, back up front end loaders and back hose, and that was the only way to remove the snow.
Friday, January 26th. Other National Guard units arrive.
Giant C-141 and C-130 transport planes began landing at Toledo Express Airport this morning. About 50 pieces of heavy Army machinery and 300 troops to operate the gear are arriving to assist in emergency operations throughout Northwest Ohio. The bulldozers, front-end loaders, and graders are from the 27th Army Engineering Battalion of the 18th Airborne Corps from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. These are the same troops who assisted in the blizzard that hit Buffalo, New York last winter.
We're going to put the troops and equipment into four task teams, as we refer to them. And their job will be to go out to the four counties which have been hardest hit, Wood, Ottawa, Hancock, and Lucas counties. The first priority, of course, will be Wood County. That's been most severely hit by the storm, and that'll be our first priority after we literally dig ourselves out of our own pile of snow here.
And some of the missions that they performed was hauling fuel oil to farm areas or isolated areas that people had no heat, applying medicine out to people, took a pregnant lady to the hospital to have her baby, picked up one man that had to have blood urinalysis, and took him to the hospital. We flew approximately 1,300 missions in the total 17 days that the units was activated.
Each task force is equipped with at least one helicopter. Choppers are being used to transport emergency victims, such as kidney dialysis and heart patients. Even a 12-hour-old baby was flown to an area hospital. The efforts here will continue until the situation throughout Northwest Ohio returns to normal. But officials aren't making any predictions when that will be. Huh? Bob Sharp, Toledo 11 News, with the minicam.
The patients were coming in for different reasons, but the ones that I remember were the pregnant women who were coming in usually as a precaution because they were due any day. And they would come in on the helicopters, and the National Guard would unload them from the helicopters, and then the hospital employees would get them from the helicopter into the emergency room. And we did that by picking up the wheelchair or stretcher or whatever, usually a wheelchair, and carrying them in. And the ones that, of course, that I won't forget are the women who are 9 months pregnant who had to be carried into the hospital. Usually four of us to a chair trying to carry them over the snow drifts and the little bumps and ridges in the parking lot. We never dropped a soul.
The National Guard and local relief agencies clear snow from approximately 8,000 miles of roads in Ohio, 300 miles in Wood County alone. The storm begins to die down. Many residents now venture out from their homes in search of food.
The supermarket business is brisk despite clogged roads.
Many walked, some for a mile to get to the stores. Others were snowmobiled, while the lucky ones drove in four-wheelers. Shelves are full in connection with non-perishable items, such as canned goods and toilet paper. Fresh vegetables seem to be in good supply. But bread and milk supplies are sparse in most stores. The reason? People are buying large numbers of an item when they might not have to.
The only problem that we're having at this time is the fact that the people are hitting us so fast, and we have not had a chance to replenish, but we have made arrangements for everything to be back in these stores. And we are making arrangements now for the people to handle everything once it gets back in the stores. We've really had great cooperation from the customers and our own people. We've got some checkers that have been working basically around the clock to help the customer get their groceries and get out.
Perhaps the best indication that people are taking this crisis in stride is the fact that beer shelves in many stores are empty. Sales began briskly at 6 o'clock last evening and have been going strong ever since. Evidently, people are getting in the spirit of the blizzard of 78. I'm Randy Little, Toledo 11 News with the Minicam in Southland.
Some people dig their way out of the snow, and the sense of urgency and fear begins to melt away. Many are able to return to abandoned homes. Interstate 75, schools and businesses reopen. The National Guard pulls out. 51 deaths are reported statewide, and property damage totals in the millions. The pace of life returns to the way it was, even though the snow remains in some places until May. Of course, there are those who are always looking to make a buck.
Yes, this winter has been a bit much. You might even say memorable. The winter storms sweeping much of the nation have proven once again that dear old Mother Nature still holds the bat hand and plays her trumps at will. Of course, some people say that in every cloud there's a silver lining. And for three Northwest Ohio firms, that lining is silver indeed. The firms are marketing Survivor T-shirts. These are message shirts which let others know that the wearers survived the blizzard of 78. Of course, those on the East Coast may well think all this survivor talk is premature.
You feel you are making light of what was a serious event for Northwest Ohio, at least.
Yeah, I think some of the people think along those lines, but I had it as bad as anyone, and we were without power and water and one thing or another, but I still think that a blizzard only comes along maybe every 100 years, so, you know, I think it's a memorable occasion, and, you know, we're not trying to cash in on anything, we're just trying to give the people what they really want.
Now, how long did it take you to mobilize?
It took us just about 24 hours to mobilize, and that was it. Until the time that we had T-shirts available in the newspaper, ads on TV, it was about 24 hours.
I don't know how many of these T-shirts will be around come August, but they're bound to be a big seller over the next few weeks as we look back and remember the big blizzard of 1978. I'm Jim Proctor, Toledo 11 News with the Mini... at ye olde Dunham Factory.
There was a lot to be learned by the blizzard. It was learned that you've got to have equipment to deal with any kind of a disaster. And I think civil defense at that time and all of our preparedness and everything, we were looking at tornadoes, basically. And this was a blizzard operation. We'd had one a year before, but it was nothing near what this one was. But it showed both the county and the city that you need to purchase equipment, be ready.
I think since the blizzard, we've tried to be much more prepared than we were before. We would be somewhat prepared if we anticipated certain weather conditions, but now we realize how suddenly weather can change, and so we try to always be prepared as much as possible with food items in the house. We have extra wood cut, and also we have an emergency kit that we keep in the trunk, which has a coffee can that we can melt snow in. We have matches, extra gloves, socks, scarf, blanket, all of those types of items to keep warm.
I think surviving through the blizzard has helped make me even more aware of how important it is for one person to help another, to know that you can overcome natural disasters and truly almost any adversity by helping each other. I'm more inclined to help other people now than I was before, whether it be through a disaster, a car accident, or just somebody falling down on the sidewalk. I think I'm a little bit more inclined to go give a hand, knowing how important it is when you're the person that needs the help.
I think what changed me maybe through the blizzard was to be a volunteer, to give of yourself to help somebody else out. Don't be shy of getting involved, and especially if you have something to give, then don't be afraid to step forward and do it.